From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. This hour is the last of our hours in which we bring candidates to you before you get a chance to vote. And I know that a number of people have already voted. In fact, every day here at Connections, we've been hearing from people who have waited in line. They've done early voting. I've seen the lines myself, and in many ways, it's been inspiring. Maybe you voted absentee. Maybe you've already put it in the mail. Our goal is, of course, to bring the interviews as early as possible. There's been a lot to schedule, and we're proud of the work we've done over recent months. We've also been working with the Monroe County Bar Association to make sure that you have a chance to hear candidates for judgeships, because for years we've heard questions from listeners along the lines of, why am I voting for judges at all? Why are judges listed on party lines? What are we supposed to know about them? How are we supposed to evaluate their qualifications? These are all fair questions. And in recent years, we've been interviewing candidates for judgeships. We think it's pretty enlightening. So in our second half hour, you're going to hear a candidate for New York State Senate. This hour, it's a candidate for the surrogate court. Judge Christopher Chacho is running. His opponent, Elena Cariola, declined to join us this hour, but it is a chance to talk to Judge Chacho, who is a candidate for this court position, and we're going to talk about his experience and why he wants this particular job. Judge Chacho, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, Evan.
Can you hear me right? I can hear you just fine, sir. Well, let's start with some of those basic questions that listeners have, and then we're going to delve into the work of what you expect to do on surrogate court. And I know you've already had some experience with that, but let's talk a little bit first about how you talk to voters when they say, hey, listen, I don't know why I've got to choose between you and your opponent. Why are we vote for judges at all? Why are judges on party lines? How do you feel about those questions?
Well, even if it were an appointment process, there's politics involved in appointments, as there are with the Supreme Court. So making it an appointment process doesn't eliminate politics altogether. As for party lines, there are a number of states in this country in which judges do not appear on party lines, and that's probably the preferred method to go. But we're stuck with the system that we have. It's been in place for a long time, and it's pretty difficult to make changes to the New York Constitution, so that's just the way it is. I think one thing that people would appreciate, I certainly would appreciate, is if you're elected for a long period of time, long term, why not in your reelection that you not, let's say, just reaffirm rather than going through a full knockdown, drag-out battle? Again, that's what other states do. You know, if a judge has proven himself to be a good judge, that he puts his name on a ballot with no opponent and the people just affirm his selection. That seems to me to be a better process. But again, we're stuck with this process. It's very, very political locally. Evan, you know, the Conservative Party dictated for a long time the choices that the Republican Party would nominate for judge. Our party, the Democratic Party, does things a little bit differently, but it's been very political for a long time.
Well, let's talk about some of the work then, because your experience has taken you into a number of different seats and kinds of work. Let our listeners know about your judicial experience, and then let's talk about why you want this particular judgeship.
Okay. So I was elected to Monroe County Court, and under our system, again, different from other states, but there is a proposal to harmonize what we do with other states. But anyway, I was elected to county court, which handles mostly criminal, but also some civil matters. It does handle search warrants and pistol permits. Because of some of the lack of experience of some of our Supreme Court judges in the civil field, and I had some civil experience, I was then designated acting Supreme Court. So right now I have 30 or 40 criminal cases, and I have 300 civil cases. Then because of an illness by the surrogate court Judge Owens earlier this year, I was asked to be a acting surrogate and to fill in when Judge Owens couldn't perform that job. And I assume that in part because of the experience I had doing surrogate court work before I was elected when I was a lawyer, and also because my father was the surrogate court judge for 17 years back in the 80s and 90s. So, yeah, I've worn a lot of different hats, Evan, in the time that I've been a Monroe County judge.
Well, on this program, we've talked to candidates for New York State Supreme Court. We've talked to candidates for county court. Surrogate court does some different work. Let our listeners know what the kind of work is.
Sure, and very few people know, but I used to be a history teacher, so excuse me for going into a little bit of history.
No, this is good because I know you didn't teach history for that long, but later on in this half hour, I do want to talk a little bit more about what you remember from that, but go ahead.
Okay. And I, one of my favorite duties as a judge is when I pick a jury in a criminal case or a civil case, I always give a discussion of how we came to have juries, what it means to be a juror, what the importance of the Magna Carta. But in any event, you know, New York was ruled by the Dutch. And under the Dutch system of law, the governor, the local governor, had jurisdiction over what's called trust and estates. In other words, the probating of will. So if a will is valid or not, if the signature on the will is valid, and what happens to the money when somebody dies, that was under the jurisdiction of the governor of the Dutch colony. And then he would designate certain delegates, which came to be called surrogates, to act in his place throughout the extensive territories of the Dutch colony. And it became known as surrogate court. So simply that the surrogate was acting in place of the governor. When New York defeated the Netherlands in war in 1664, the English system took over the Dutch system, but retained this name of surrogate court, which the jurisdiction of which became to probate estates. In other words, to make sure that wills are valid and that money is going to the people that are entitled to receive it. Now, originally, again, under the Dutch system, it was known as widows and orphans court because its special prerogative was to make sure that when a breadwinner husband died, that his widow and his children were going to get the money that he left to them. That term widows and orphans court was not used after the English took over, but it still remained in some use such that, and I refer to this on my website, Bobby Kennedy in 1965 tried to work out a reform of surrogates court, and he referred to it as widows and orphans court. And he said that widows and orphans court is a political toll booth exacted upon those very widows and orphans. And that has to do with the fees which the surrogate court can award to attorneys who take appointments that come out of the court. But its fundamental function is to make sure that estates are valid and that the money gets distributed efficiently to the people who are entitled to take it. And the importance of the court ends up being that, you know, in any given year, tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars flows through that supervision of the surrogates court. And as the baby boom generation passes on, we're going to see what's been called the greatest transfer of wealth in human history. And those numbers are going to only increase.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting, referring to it as the greatest transfer of wealth in history. And essentially looking at making sure that process is fair. Tell me a little bit about what fairness means to you in that context. If you are a surrogate court judge and you're overseeing the greatest transfer of wealth in history, what in your experience prepares you, in your view, to do this job well? And then maybe conversely, if you could, give me a sense for if this job is not done well, what happens?
Sure. So the first thing is efficiency, that things get done quickly so that estates aren't lingering in surrogates court without that money moving. I've heard from landlords, or actually I've heard from neighborhood activists, which say that, you know, sometimes there'd be an estate person dies, they own a piece of property, and that property just sits there because there's a delay in the appointment of an executor or a delay in some aspect of the transfer, and it becomes what they call a zombie house. So efficiency is number one. People want to get their money as soon as possible. Number two is transparency. People don't know why the fees that get charged. They don't know what the process entails. And I think in what I do in my court is, I pick up the phone when people call, and it drives my staff a little crazy. But I like talking to people and telling them about this is what's going on in your case. So transparency is a big part of what should happen in surrogates court. The third thing is active engagement by the surrogate to settle cases. Family members fight over assets. It's just a fact of life. And if the surrogate doesn't engage himself in working out settlements, then you're going to have these estates lingering for years. I've mediated as the acting Supreme Court judge, dozens of cases and achieved really good results in working things out between parties to a lawsuit. So conflict resolution, you might call it, is one thing. And then lastly is lack of partisanship and fairness. There have been scandals downstate. I'm not going to refer to anything up here, but there have been scandals which have been documented in the New York Times and elsewhere about scandals downstate where these very lucrative appointments made by the surrogate judge go into the hands of party supporters who in turn get dictated by party chairmen. There's a story that in the 1930s, when Franklin Roosevelt tried to break the hold of Tammany Hall, it was Tammany's control of Surrogates Court that kept them afloat. And then, of course, in 1965, when Bobby Kennedy tried to reform Surrogates Court, it had to do with the appointments that came out of Surrogates Court, which are in the tens of millions of dollars. It's a lot of money, Evan, that goes to the court. So lack of partisanship and fairness, transparency, efficiency, and conflict resolution are the things I'd like to see as part of a surrogate court tenure.
Let me ask you a little bit about the fact that family members do fight over assets. And I hope it's obvious to listeners that even though we're talking about, you know, many millions of dollars that will transfer in terms of the coming baby boom and the current baby boom generation transferring its legacy to heirs. And, you know, it's not always big dollar figures. I mean, families can get torn apart over property disputes, over who owns a house, over who owns what portions of a house, over who's done the work and is should be entitled. I'm curious to know, just generally speaking, what counsel, what advice you might provide for listeners who might have struggled with this in the past or might be struggling right now with family disputes. And unfortunately, I've seen it, you know, sort of, thankfully not directly in my own life, but I mean, I'm certainly aware of friends who've gone through this. What advice do you have for people to try to avoid those disputes that can tear families apart over assets?
And this is, you can find this online. I'm not being unique in saying this. The most important thing is to have a conversation with your parents about what's going to happen to their estate before they die. So that, number one, they make a will, and number two, that the will is sufficiently clear and made known to people in advance as to what's going to happen, so that those conversations can take place before the person passes away and not afterwards. So that eliminates a lot of sort of the hard feelings that come about when there's an estate and things happen in that estate that the people weren't aware of that was going to happen. Secondly, just having a will avoids a lot of disputes because a lot of people die without a will or a very inadequate will. So have those conversations first. Number two, make sure that your parents or whoever it is that you're looking out for has a will. Those are two very important things to do. Beyond that, Evan, you'd like to say that people shouldn't care so much about money, but they do because it's A, money, and they might need the money. Number two, a lot of these things that get passed on have sentimental value. And mean something beyond what the monetary value is of a particular item. And fights can break out over those things as well. So, that's the advice that I would give. Just, you know, that's not necessarily a judge's advice. And it's really, I learned that advice as an attorney. And you can go online and look that up or talk to any good estate planning attorney in town. They'll tell you the same thing.
Well, let me grab a phone call from Jane in Rochester briefly. Go ahead, Jane.
Hi. Yeah, I just want to say that I'm really sorry that we're losing Judge Chiaccia from his previous court position. I had the opportunity to witness him at work with a friend who had a hearing that was a very critical one and a controversial one. And I was so impressed with Judge Chiaccia. This was, I believe, 6 years ago. He was so compassionate, so caring, just deeply understood the complexity of a very complex case, and his decision was terrific, and I just hate to lose him in the position he's been in because he's been doing such amazing work.
Well. Thanks, Jane. You know, let me just say one thing, that I will continue to be acting Supreme Court and continue to do a lot of the civil work I've done, and I'll probably continue to do some of the criminal work, and the reform that's been proposed by Judge DeFiore is to make everybody Supreme Court judges so that they do multiple types of work. So I don't intend to give up that work completely, but I do hope to bring some of those skills I learned in my previous roles to the surrogate court position. Thanks, Jane. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Jane. We're talking to Judge Christopher Chiaccia, who's running for the surrogate court. His opponent, Elena Cariola, declined to join us on this program. So we've got him for a few more minutes. Andrew says he's pretty sure his mother does not have a will. What happens when someone passes away without a will? What's the process, Judge?
Great question, Evan. So there's a position called public administrator, and that gets appointed by the surrogate. And the public administrator's job is to administer act like an executor of a will, of those wills and estates where the person dies without a will. Now, it can be a family member if there's a competent, qualified family member to act as administrator, but oftentimes the public administrator comes in here in Monroe County. So the public administrator for the last 20 years here is a gentleman by the name of Frank Icavangelo. The surrogate named a deputy public administrator his daughter, and that's my opponent. And they're both partners in a firm called Gallo and Icavangelo, which does the legal work for the public administrator. So in many cases, the public administrator takes over that estate. There was an article in the Democratic Chronicle some time ago about Tony D's, the restaurant, and the owners of Tony D's died close in time, and neither of them had a will. So Mr. Icavangelo took over the management of that estate and earned quite a lot of money doing it, as recounted in that article. But that's what happens when there's no will. The public administrator can, and oftentimes does, take over the management of that estate, and then the money is distributed according to a statute that says this is how the money gets distributed and in what shares. So that would be according to law.
I imagine that is a real recipe for tearing families up, though, not having a will, and all of a sudden you've got descendants who are arguing over what goes where.
It's a terrible thing, Evan, sure. And, you know, my father had an estate that lasted 17 years. The entire time that he was on the bench, the estate kept on going, fighting between siblings and relatives. And there's a couple of those I know that I'm familiar with that are up in circuits court now. Yeah.
Talking to Judge Christopher Chacho, who taught history for at least a little while, in the early 1980s, I think, right, at McQuaid?
Yeah, I taught at McQuaid, left to go to law school, came back and taught at MCC, and then this past year I taught at St. John Fisher a course on the history of incarceration, just sort of an interest of mine, and had a lot of fun doing it, and if it wasn't for COVID, I think I'd be doing it again this semester.
Yeah, I hear you. But I want to ask just a little about your high school experience because, you know, every time we have candidates for judgeships on this program, I think our audience that is generally pretty well-educated still has a lot to learn, myself included. What do you remember about high school students and how impressed or not you were about their knowledge of history before they got to you?
High school students?
Yeah.
So, yeah, the course I taught was at St. John Fisher, but
I'm thinking about McQuaid back in the 80s.
Yeah, in the 70s for me. I had a really, really good teacher my junior year of high school who it wasn't called an AP class, but it was like an AP class. And he had a textbook that we read from the most learned treatises on American history that were out there. You know, Arthur Schlesinger and Francis Parkman and Bernard Balin and Charles and Nancy Beard. It was great, great stuff. And I really appreciate the time that he put into it. Before that, John Roselli was a world or global history teacher. Jack Achille was our European teacher. And they were just great teachers. And I think, you know, the general knowledge of history was pretty broad at McQuaid. When I taught there, I was in American history class. The AP class was great, and I sort of taught them the same way that my teacher, Mr. Forget, had taught me. So I think it's still pretty high.
Well, you mentioned earlier this hour, and I made a little note, the importance of the Magna Carta. Maybe we'll start to close our conversation with that, because I feel like I would fail your class if you asked me to write about that, and I should know more. Can you remind our listeners about that?
So the Magna Carta was an agreement between the leading nobles and commercial merchants and the king. And what was revolutionary about it is that it limited what the king could do in terms of interfering with their business activities. And they laid that on a charter, and they met on a very marshy ground outside of London, and it was purposely picked because they couldn't have a battle because it was so marshy. And they got the king to sign this agreement of restrictions on his power. And so those restrictions became part of English law. So whenever the king would assert his power, they could always go back to this seminal document, the Magna Carta, and say, look, your powers are limited because of what you signed or your descendants signed back in 1215. And one of those restrictions was that no person could have a judgment against them except by a judgment of their peers. So we got the jury trial put into writing, put into that Magna Carta, and that was always pulled out whenever there was an attempt to take somebody's land or take somebody's money or put somebody in jail without due process. So you have to give this person a trial by a jury of their peers. And that's why we have jury trials today, is because of what the Magna Carta insisted on back in 1215.
One of the early ideas about checks and balances, it sounds like.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, if you go back farther, there were some checks and balances, but this was a crucial point in English history where King John was asserting his power over the nobles and the commercial merchants. And this was a very important restriction on his power. And it was always sort of a defense whenever King Henry VIII or King George III or whoever it was tried to assert their power over the people. And the Magna Carta always stood in the king's way. So
I'm really enjoying the history conversation. We should have just done this the whole hour.
I would have been happy to do that. Anytime I'd be happy to come back on and talk about it.
Well, here's your last minute then. I just had to talk to my 8-year-old about checks and balances and about the 3 branches of government and the idea that none of the branches is supposed to be heavier or more important than the other in this country. How are we doing as a country with making sure those branches are not outweighing one another and our checks and balances working?
I think we're doing really, really well, Evan. You know, even within Monroe County, within the world that I inhabit here, the judges act as a check on the interests of the powerful. You know, there's big time cases come before me and in front of the other judges, and you get pushed and pulled in different directions by certain sentiments. But we act as a check upon the powerful and moneyed interests in Monroe County, and I think judges do that throughout the rest of the country. So it's a great system of checks and balances. I think it's unparalleled in the rest of the world, maybe with the possible exception of England. But we do a really, really good job. We stand between, and I say this to the jurors when I convene a grand jury, we stand between, in criminal cases, between the police and the people. We stand between, and we act as sometimes as gatekeepers, as people who sort of tamp down the passions of the moment and give reasoned decisions. And that's what we do. And when it's done well, it's a wonderful thing.
Judge, let listeners know your website if they want to learn more about you.
Yeah, I think it's Chacho for Judge, www.chachoforjudge. And the Facebook page has a lot of information too, which is Judge Chacho for Surrogate Judge. Thanks, Evan.
I love that you think that's what it is, because that means you're not all that political an animal. You're pretty sure you got a website. Chacho is spelled...
I'm not that political. No, I'm not.
C-I-A-C-C-I-O is Christopher yes. Chacho's name. Judge Chacho, thanks for the time, and we'll talk again.
Thanks, Evan.
I want to let our listeners know his opponent in the race for surrogate court is Elena Cariola. If you want to learn more, you can search for her information as well. She declined an invitation to join us on this program, as is her right, but we seek to bring all candidates to you when we can, at length, before you vote.